to the Aftershocks Central Podcast with Martin and Travis. Ronnie is out on assignment today, so it's just us two.
What's up?
What up, gangster?
Yeah, too bad we missed Ronnie again, man. It was not easy putting it together this week.
Yeah, this week was rough, man. I fell asleep, and then Ronnie's battery died, and now we're here.
Yeah, we'll get him back next week. We'll be back to Voltron soon.
Yeah, we'll be back soon. There's quite a bit to talk about. We got a new book announcement that I'm pretty excited about. It's
hell yeah, dude.
The Lollipop Kids, written by Adam Glass with art by Diego Yapur. And I couldn't find any info on the guy, but I think he's an Argentine artist. So that's cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
I think that, if I remember correctly, like the article might have mentioned like some collaboration that he and Adam had done before, but I could be making that up.
Yeah, I thought you were right, but you know, I tried to find it in this article real quick and I didn't see it. So maybe it was in something else that I read about this. But, yeah, cool to see Adam Glass back on something, you know? I think we all dug the normals. We all obviously loved Rough Riders. So it's nice that, even though he's busy at DC doing Teen Titans, he's still gonna be doing, another Aftershock book.
Yeah, dude. Good to keep those, heavy hitters in the fold.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and this one seems interesting, actually, in that, in the article they mention that it's kind of co-written by Adam's son.
Yeah, so from my understanding is the idea behind this came from Adam's son. And basically it's about a group of kids that fight things that go bump in the night.
Yeah, like in Central Park, right?
Yeah, in Central Park. Which I think is cool.
Yeah.
I think it's cool. I have a little concern with the cover though. You looked at the cover, yeah?
Yeah.
Alright, so do you have the cover in front of you?
No, I don't.
Alright, if you can picture it, what's wrong with the cover?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, so this might not be a final cover image, is my assumption. But the logo for the book is at the bottom.
Huh.
Yeah. Now, I personally don't care. However, I think this is a problem for comic shops. Because usually comic shops put these things in waterfall racks, and the bottom piece of the cover is cut off. So that's why usually you have publishers doing the logos on the top. So you have the publisher logo on the top left, you have the book logo on the top middle, and the issue number on the top right. But this book doesn't have that. And I wonder if so this is being billed as a YA book, right? Young adult slash all audiences. And makes sense based on the subject matter, the fact that Adam's son is kind of like co-creator, co-writer on this thing. But I think if this is to be successful on a comic rack, they need to put the logo up top. Just a thought.
Yeah, I think that I heard somebody saying a similar thing about people that sell Virgin covers, like stuff without the logos, that has a hard time in comic shops because you have to pick it up and open it to figure out what it is.
Yeah, yeah. So. Yeah, see, I like the Virgin covers, though. They're really nice looking.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a variant, so assumedly, you know, like, you order it or ask for it, you know, so you don't necessarily need to track it down on a rack.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. I don't know, maybe because it's a YA book, it's, they're hoping maybe they're racked differently. I know some shops have, like, dedicated kids sections, maybe, so if you were to put it there, it might look different, but, I don't know. My real assumption is that this is gonna be, not the final cover image.
Yeah. They could always just turn it upside down in the rack, you know, so. That might, like, get some attention.
Yeah, that might work. That might work. All right, we've got a couple books to talk about this week, so let's do that.
Word.
We've got Betrothed number 5. Unfortunately, Ronnie's not here to discuss his favorite Aftershock book, but we can talk about it. This is written by Sean Lewis with art by Steve Wee, letters by Simon Bolan. And it's the final issue.
Is it?
I thought it was.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have the same kind of tease about like volume one or like the end for now or anything like that. It definitely closes the door harder than most Aftershock titles do.
I thought it left the ending was pretty open though for another volume.
Yeah, dude. I mean, like, they really lean on it pretty hard right there at the end. It was like, you have even greater challenges to come or whatever. And it's like, oh, like, I don't know. Like, maybe that's the story that they, you know, like, It's an odd choice to leave off with, like, but we're only beginning, and like that was just a warm up like bout, you know. If you don't then continue, it just, you know, like it feels like it diminishes what you just read.
Does it? I thought the ending was pretty satisfactory.
Well, I mean, like, it's interesting, I guess. I'd say there's probably some stuff that I don't understand about the story and where it was going. Like specifically, you know, in this issue, the villain, Tamara's sister, she's talking about, we've got some like villains that are coming up in the future, and that's why we're getting rid of the betrothed, is because they can't hack it. And if we're going to survive, he needs to be me leading, you know. But at the same time, you know, I don't know. I was kind of questioning whether the stuff that she was seeing in the mist was correct, or whether she was just misinterpreting it, you know?
Well, it seems to me like she is just overconfident. That's all. That's the way that I took it. Because, I mean, it's pretty obvious to me by the events of this book that Tamara does have what it takes to lead her people. I mean, she shoots her sister in the head, you know?
Oh, yeah, dude. Like, she goes full murder, like, the whole time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would say this is definitely the most violent issue of the whole series.
Yeah, I mean, but they also kind of do the, like, wand wave at the end to clean it up. So, technically, did it happen? You know, that's a semantics issue, I guess.
Okay, maybe. But even with the little wand wave, as you said, there's a lot that happens to resolve the story, I would say. It does seem like it happened pretty quickly. Like, I could have seen another issue come out of this to expand this final battle. Because really, the battle itself only took, like, two pages, you know? Like,
yeah.
You have the good side preparing, the bad side preparing, and then finally they meet, and Tamara and what's the guy's name?
Kieran.
They have all the high school kids with them. They use their magic Wumbo Wumbo to give them all energy weapons. And, I mean, the fight literally takes, like, two panels, right? Because as soon as the bad guys break into the school, they just all get shot down, and they're all dead. And then Tamara's sister comes up, and Tamara just shoots her in the head, and that's kind of the end of that.
Yeah, I mean, it does, like, feel a little rushed, I guess. You know, I think maybe what occurs to me is it doesn't seem like that is really the kind of central story of the series. Like, my read is that, you know, like, the most significant storyline in the whole thing is, like, will they bone, you know? Like, you know, I kind of, it almost is like a metaphor, you know, for them kind of accepting their destiny as the betrothed or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I was a little,
you know what I mean?
I was a little confused about that too, by the way. Because I thought the whole thing was they wouldn't achieve their full potential until they actually consummated. And we don't see them consummate, but obviously their powers have grown quite a bit from last issue to this issue. And when Tamara's sister and her whole crew are going through the mist, they're like, what's going on? Well, like, what is all this? And she's like, oh, like, they've consummated. And like, that was never shown, right?
Dude, they kind of point to it, you know, like she shoves him down the desk and it's like, it's happening, you know?
Yeah, I guess.
And I thought it was interesting that it wasn't really, in my opinion, motivated on her account for, like, oh, I'm so overcome with my feelings for this dude. It's like, oh, I saw other dude get shot and now he's dying. And that really just makes me think that, like, I want to get laid before I die.
Mm.
Like, that was kind of her framing. Kieran, on the other hand, in previous issues, like, I love this girl, you know, like, he's, you know, like, I think buying more into the relationship, like, we didn't necessarily get that expressed from her, any kind of, like, admiration for this dude.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, oh, I want to bone before I die. And, you know, not worrying about the dude who was laying dying, you know, like, to provide that example, you know, they're like, you're good. Don't worry about us. We're going to go do some stuff for a few minutes, but we'll be back.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess you're right. I guess. I don't know. It was an interesting issue, though. I think I enjoyed this one quite a bit. It seemed a lot more straightforward in the storytelling than the previous ones. It just surprised me that things ended so quickly, you know? And you mentioned the wand waving. I wasn't expecting that at all, right? Because, like, they have the one friend that was pretty much dying as it was. You've got all these bad guys that got killed during the battle. You've got all these high school kids that know what's going on now. And does the wand waving kind of make them lose their memory of that also? Does this mean that, like, Tamara's sister's not dead anymore? They brought her back to life? Or, like, how does this affect everybody else?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely kind of left pretty vague, you know. I would assume, I wasn't sure if among those they brought back were, like, the baddies who got killed for good reason, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, they, like, fix up the school and they save all the students, I guess, which works for me because there was something about bringing the fight back to their high school and being like, well, you know, you guys are here and like some of you are our friends. So, better fight for your life, which also helps us. You know, like, and, you know, there's no, adults or, you know, any kind of authorities there. I thought it was very strange that they get back and they're just like, you guys got to defend yourselves because, we're here and putting you into harm's way. But, here's like a magic axe thingy.
Yeah. I like the magic axe thingy.
It's tight. Yeah.
Yeah. It was cool. All right. Let's wrap this one up. You want to give it a rating?
Yeah. I would just say, I think that, I kind of wish that they had done a little bit more world building in general. You know, we definitely got a lot of the high school stuff, and I get that there's not a lot of space to really build up the high concept sci-fi story that was supposed to be the counterbalance. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like I feel like that was all very kind of broad strokes. And, you know, like, you know, I would have liked a little bit more about, like, really digging into the alien planet side of it. Yeah. So I think I'll go 3 out of 5 on this one.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. I think I'm right there with you, dude. I think, you know, the whole series was interesting to me. It's just not something that wowed me with every issue, you know? But it was definitely interesting to read, and I wouldn't mind seeing another volume if that is in the works. I just looked at the last page, and it does say the end, you know, not even, like, continued in volume 2. So I don't know if we will see a second volume, but I wouldn't mind seeing one if it does what you said, you know, if it explores this world that we're supposed to care about it being saved, but we don't really know anything about it. So I'm not sure, like, if I wanted to care about what we're saving, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting in that it was kind of framed early on as, like, just the betrothed getting together is, like, the salvation, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, that's going to be what saves these tribes. But, you know, like, the conclusion kind of implies that, like, you know, that's only the beginning, you know? So I wouldn't mind seeing more as well, kind of from that perspective.
Yep, agreed. All right, let's go to Relay number 1. This is written by Zach Thompson. We've got art by Andy Clark and colors by Dan Brown. And Donnie Cates is mildly involved in this, but kind of not really. So I want to talk about this. Did you happen to reread the Zero issue before or after reading this first one?
Yes, I did.
Okay, good. So I wanted to, but I did not. So I do vaguely remember the whatever happened in the Zero issue. And I think what's interesting is, even though this is a first issue, having read that Zero issue definitely does give you a lot of additional information about the world of Relay that you wouldn't get simply from this one story. Would you agree?
Absolutely, dude. It's like, you know, one of the central things is, like the myth of the first planet or whatever, you know, right. Like Donald's planet. That's what we saw.
Yep.
But, you know, like it was told a very interesting way because there's kind of like narrative uncertainty. It's very much couched in the like, this is a legend and we don't really know who was the first one to tell it, you know? So it's not entirely reliable.
So I had a question for you. You're out in Hollywood. You know, Zach loves his sci-fi movies. Did you get any vibes of pre-existing sci-fi movies in this? Because I talked to Ronnie a little bit about it, and he totally saw Total Recall on this.
Hmm.
And I'm going to give you one example of that. Matter of fact, in the very first page, when Jad is in the taxi cab, the flying taxi cab with the punk guy, and there's a like an android driver, I guess, maybe, or at least he's in the seat. That exact character is actually in Total Recall.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, he's the guy that drives Arnold around Mars.
That's cool. Yeah. I mean, well, to that question, obviously, I think you have to acknowledge the kind of fundamental debt to 2001 A Space Odyssey, you know, like, mm-hmm. like, i.e. the monoliths.
Yep.
So that's a clear, you know, homage, I guess. And beyond that, I would throw in just a hair of Minority Report.
Definitely Minority Report.
Specifically, like, the guns that they use.
Yep.
To me, like looked a lot like what they used in Minority Report.
So I'm surprised you didn't mention Judge Dredd, because to me, this was a lot like reading Judge Dredd.
Hmm.
I mean, the city that has built around Relay reminds me so much of Mega City 1. And then, you know, you got, Jad and William, and I can't remember the girl's name, but they're not as hardcore as the judges, but they definitely have similar motivations for doing their job, right? Like, the law is the law. And so they don't really doubt that. Although I think as the issue progresses, I do wonder if, like, Jad, for example, doesn't doubt some of the reasoning behind this planet, right? In particular with like how much Donaldson takes center stage in this particular issue.
Yeah, dude, like I see my read, and I was wondering about the same thing, is like, you know, Burns and Victoria, who's like the other cop.
Yep.
I think that's the name. I have it written down. I take them as kind of like open skeptics, you know, they seem to be like the whole time be the ones that are saying like, it's not real, dude. You know, like this is, you know, Burns is the one who's talking about like the planet is a myth to keep us busy. You know, but like kind of spinning our wheels. Mm. And, you know, I think that the lady is even more outspoken. I'm kind of wondering about Jad, who kind of seems more straightforward. But my assumption is that he's the one who's narrating.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and, like, there seems to be a little bit more, you know, uncertainty in the text boxes. But he's, you know, he doesn't strike me as being vocally, like, dissenting, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I think one of the things that really jumped at me, sci-fi-wise, in terms of inspiration, is like the Foundation series. I don't know if you ever read Asimov, but there's a lot of that in here. And you know, like I said, I know Zach loves sci-fi. He's a huge Philip K. Dick fan. Because I mean, like, there's like hints of like Blade Runner in here for sure. You know, if you're versed in this kind of story, I think that the inspirations are pretty clear. But man, I really dug it because it was so much different. And you know, trying to think back on the story that the Zero issue gave me, I'm trying to place how we get from the story told in Zero issue to the story that we're seeing here. Because, you know, the way that the Relay is revered by some people in this story, it seems to me like the monolith is almost like an AI, right? Like a sentient thing that can dictate what can and cannot be done. And I don't know if that's necessarily entirely true, because I think, isn't there mention of like a committee or something that lives inside the Relay?
They talk about going inside the Relay. But I don't know what's inside. specifically.
Yeah, okay. So maybe it's just extrapolating from that. But like there's got to be something telling these people how to live their lives, right? And what I found really interesting is obviously this book is about like monoculture, right? Because basically any planet that accepts the monolith lives by the monolith's rules. If you don't accept the monolith, then you're exterminated. And basically anybody that assimilates into this monoculture, their main purpose is to continue expanding the reach of the relay system, right? So in the system that this book takes place in, all the known planets that are inhabited have a relay, right? They're in the relay system. And even through that, they have colony ships that they send out to find new planets with intelligent life that they could seed more relays into and make them part of this culture. I got that right, right? I'm not missing something on that.
No, I think you're on board. I mean, I kind of am curious about, you know, what exactly is the nature of the colony ships? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you're right. They like basically they're looking for uncolonized worlds, which doesn't mean uninhabited, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What interested me about the colony ships was that there seems to be a large group of people that are like in cryostasis.
Yeah.
But there's also people, like these the main characters here that are just going to be doing their thing for 2 weeks or however long they're on the, you know, like they're not in cryo sleep.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up because, like Jed says that, right? He's like, I can't wait to be on the ship. It's like being in a party for a couple weeks. And they show like a few panels of that, you know, the stuff that happens in the colony ship. And, you've got like this, like, Quidditch soccer football type thing going on in the stadium. It looks like every floor is basically a shopping mall with bars and stores, and that's about it. And then you do see, as Jazz walking, you see all these colonists in cryostasis, which makes me think, like, why does a ship exist, right? Because if they're trying to colonize people, does that mean that everybody that's hanging out on the ship is not a colonist? And if so, why are they allowed on the ship, right? Because the colonists are the ones in cryo. And so my assumption is when they get to an uninhabited planet, the colonists stay and everybody else keeps going. So as a person that lives in this society, why wouldn't you just want to hang out on the colony ship all the time? Because you're pretty much just hanging out. Like literally you're partying 24/7.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if it's that. You know, once they go and, you know, effectively convert the new world, you know, whether at that point you let loose a bunch of these like cryo colonists and they are like, they're the new government or something, you know,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, they're kind of like inserted there to maintain control or, you know, I don't know. I'm just kind of spitballing, but I thought that was an interesting thing. And, you know, also kind of, you know, with respect to what is the mission of the colony ships, I what interests me, I guess, is do you think they're heading towards like the fabled first world? You know, like maybe that's what it is. Once they find Donaldson's world, all the colonists get out. Because, you know, earlier in the issue, They have a pretty significant scene where the guy, you know, is like, I found evidence of the first world, you know, and at the end of the issue, they kind of show a landscape that I think looks a little bit like the planet from issue zero.
Yes.
So there's something significant there. Obviously, there's the fundamental question of like, is the first world real in any respect? Is it totally fabricated? You know, like, what are they going to find there? But I would be surprised on some level if that story isn't headed there with these characters.
So I have a suggestion. What if this culture is so, we'll say strict in their rules, right? Like, I think part of the problem that I had with this issue, and I'm not saying I did not like it, by the way, but one of the problems I have with this issue is there's a lot of focus in this issue on people that do not believe in this relay monoculture, right? Like, there's a guy that sets up the device at the mall. There's a guy, I think, when they're like getting ready to enter the colony ship. There's a couple people, right? Where you there's a lot of focus on them, and obviously it's these people's job to apprehend anybody who goes against the will of the relay. But the main focus is on them, and there's a ton of people on this planet, and there's a ton of people on this colony ship. So, I mean, what if it's really a simple answer? What if the people in cryo are like the true believers, right? And then the people who are hanging out on the ship are allowed on the ship in order to kind of keep them busy so that they don't have to think about their way of life, if that makes sense. I'm just trying to think of like cult psychology, right? In cults, like the cult leader would always have members of the cult do like repetitive menial tasks in order to keep them busy away from having some kind of thought on leaving the cult. And really, like, the only times you have community time or the times that you see the leader is during, like, I guess, like, worship times, for example, right? And it seems like the only way to accomplish what the relay system has accomplished is to have this, like, a similar system, right? Set it up kind of like a cult, where, like, the true believers are rewarded, but everybody else has to be kept busy in order to not think about not wanting to be part of the system.
Yeah, I'll buy that, dude.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, I have to say, I think that is one of the most interesting things about the story so far is kind of the emphasis on, you know, it seems like they're going for objectivity, you know, like basically, you know, in order for anything to be real, it needs to be objectively real. And the way that they achieve that is to erase any kind of conflicting belief or worldview or reality, you know. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it's playing with heady stuff as far as nature of reality and subjectivity and objectivity. And obviously, you know, you're taking that and turning it into a framework of government, you know. So, you know, like, there's kind of a lot to unpack there about, you know, like kind of totalitarian governments and, you know, theocracies. I don't know. I think that is interesting, you know, and obviously, that the whole thing seems to be motivated by religion or a religious type, you know, belief centric organization as opposed to something that's more, typical governments or, you know, kind of commerce.
Yeah.
Things that we're used to conquering, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. That's a good point. Do we know if this is Earth or somewhere else?
Where the main story is?
Yes.
I think so, because they make a few references to Earth, you know, like specifically like when they brought the relay to Earth, which is about 300 years ago, I think.
Yeah, okay.
Which interests me as well, just like the kind of time frame that it has existed, you know, like if it's, you know, the span of a few hundred years that this thing has conquered the known universe or is like making big inroads to that, you know, it's a very interesting thing, especially if it's basically a religion, you know, to mm-hmm. think that this thing, you know, didn't used to exist pretty recently and now it's like dominating the universe.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, I don't know, like, what the, we don't know what the technology is, right, here. I do find it interesting that, you know, you mentioned that 300-year time frame. If the monolith came to Earth in the somewhat near future, the ability to set up a relay system across all the known worlds, if Earth had been one of the first, would be nearly impossible. Right. Based on like the technology we have to travel through space. And obviously, like, this society has much more advanced technology because they can share all these resources being part of the relay system, right? Like, we don't have colony ships, and we're nowhere near that, right? Our ships don't travel that fast, right? Like, it would take us, like, 50,000 years to get to the next closest star. So, like, there's obviously a lot of jumps that civilizations go through once they get in as part of this relay system. And obviously, Donaldson, what I find interesting is that his name is Donaldson, which is such a, like, it seems like a such a normal name, you know? But there's no way that he can be human, right? Like, that the first planet, if what we see is the first planet, has three suns, from what I can tell. So it's obviously not Earth, or at least in our solar system. So why does he go by Donaldson, right? Or, like, is that just something, is that the name that this being chose when he brought the relay to Earth, right? Because that would be a name that we would easily associate with. Because, I mean, he looks pretty normal to me, right? He looks like a lumberjack. He looks like Paul Bunyan.
Word, yeah. And you know, kind of to your point as well, like, if we're going to assume that Earth didn't have the capacity, the technology to travel, like, interstellar trips, you know, if that was something that was brought by the relay, that certainly would imply that he wasn't from Earth. But there's still a lot about Donaldson and the first planet and all that is so couched in did it happen, that, you know, like, I don't know, there's some uncertainty there, you know. I think the technology is the question. It's like, you know, did somebody have this technology secretly and wasn't sharing it? And they just were like, oh, it turns out that, like, we can go, like, faster than light, no problem. But we didn't choose, you know, we're now choosing to tell you, and also, like, we're going to go conquer the universe. I thought it was interesting, just, you know, tangentially, that, you know, they talked about finding evidence on a dig on Luna.
Yeah, right.
Which could be the moon.
Yep.
So, I, you know, that, if that is something, kind of implies that, you know, like, maybe Donaldson was from Earth and there's some kind of crazy twist in the story. And also, as an aside, the concept of digging into the moon ties back again to A Space Odyssey. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Yep, I agree. You know, the one thing that I really like is that this book rewards you if you picked up the Zero issue, right? A lot of times when you have Free Comic Book Day books, they're just kind of like rehash material or just like kind of BS-y stuff. But some publishers do, like, for example, I was talking about, what is it, Shadow Roads, the new Cullen Bunn book. The full issue was out on Free Comic Book Day. And then, I mean, the book just came out like 2 weeks ago. But what I like about this is if you picked up that Zero issue, you get so much background that really gets you thinking, right? Because I don't think we could really have a lot of the conversation that we just had we not read Relay Number Zero. And I wonder what the experience is for somebody who has not read Relay Zero and picks this up. How much more confusion will there be?
Yeah, I think it's fair. You know, I think you could pick it up with issue one and read and get a lot of it. You know, if you're just kind of taking things on face value, you know, like they kind of express a lot of doubt throughout this issue, I think, that, like, the first planet is true. It's just, you know, we actually know the substance of what that legend is, as it's probably told pretty frequently.
Yep.
So I think that's just, you know, kind of a fascinating extra, you know, that like we actually do see the story and how it's supposed to be told.
Yep. For anyone listening that did not pick up issue zero, you can get it for free on Comixology.
I was just gonna say that, actually.
Yeah. Gotcha.
We're on the same wavelength, dude.
But yeah. What else do you want to say about this one, or should we wrap it up?
Okay, I got one more thing, I guess, that I don't think we've really touched on. It's just, two more things. Quickly, there's like a couple panels in here where he has a kind of significant interaction, like kind of just eye contact with a lady with pink hair
yep.
and chopsticks.
Yep.
And it was like, just that it was two panels like that makes me wonder if that character is going to show up or something, you know, or they just liked her design so much. They're like, you're getting two panels of this chick.
No, no. I think, I mean, I've been reading comics for many a year, and I would say that this person will play some kind of role in the story, right?
Okay, word. All right, we're on the same page there.
Yeah.
Okay, other thing. It's something you brought up, actually, earlier, which is the first scene. I was very confused what's going on, you know? Like,
yeah, yeah.
So, like, we're in the cab, and the dude's, like, looks like rubbing his wrist or something, you know? And they have a little stare down, and the guy's trying to draw his gun, and the other guy kicks him out of the cab, you know?
Yep.
So, I don't know. Do you think that is significant, or that's just supposed to be your, like, this is what kind of cop this dude is, you know?
Yeah, no, I took that as kind of just an introduction, right? Like, I figured somehow he jumped into this car, because in the first panel, there's another car right behind it. So I figured somehow he jumped into this one, and, like, this is a guy that he was looking for, and they duked it out. Didn't work out very well. And fortunately for him, his partner, William, was right there behind him. So he was saved. But really, yeah, it just, you know, just to show the character. And you learn a lot about how this city is set up from these couple of panels, right? Cause you get to see the full cityscape. You get to see the flying cars. You get to see like the technology, the fashion. You'd learn a lot about this culture just from these first like two pages. So I don't think we'll see that guy again, but I could be wrong.
Yeah. Well, just on that point, I feel like there's more in two pages of this book than there is in like a full issue of a lot of series, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Like you're just like, digging into it, and you're like, what does all this mean, you know? And, you know, it's credit also to the art, because there's a lot of, you know, fine detail, and you are able to do certain storytelling things that you don't have to, like, put into text, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, it's a good read.
Yeah, one of my favorite pages is probably, like, page 4, I think, when he's falling down before Burns catches him on his flying motorcycle, and you have that holographic advertising in the background, the D-Cola, and it's like, D-Cola, phenomenal. I just love that. I just love that. And my assumption is it's Donaldson Cola, right? Cause it's D-Cola.
Oh, yeah, it's gotta be. Yeah. And yeah, cause his face is obscured.
Yeah. Exactly.
He's wearing a bag over his, and he drinks the beer through a sack.
Through a sack. And I mean, he's wearing the flannel shirt. So, I mean, you know, it's gotta be Donaldson Cola.
Good call, dude.
Yeah. I love the little Easter eggs in here. There's quite a few. There was like a mention of Hyperion, which is a long, sci-fi fantasy series as well. You know, you've got the Da Vinci or the Michelangelo reference on the graffiti wall, when that girl does the, Donaldson with all the farmers behind him. There's quite a few. Obviously the Blade Runner stuff with all the Japanese and Chinese advertising. Really awesome.
Yeah, it's tight, dude.
Yeah. To go with what you said about the amount of detail, I don't know if you looked at the script page at the end of the book. There's three pages. And so on the first page, you have a script page that has the exact script that Zach wrote. And then you have the next page where you have the black and white coloring with the inks. And then the next page, which is the colored art. And then I think you have like a final rendition. And I love that kind of stuff. But if you read that page, the little segment they show is basically like three panels, and it's like the most dense comic scripting I've ever seen. Like I've looked at some comic scripts before, like the level of detail in that script for basically a giant panel and two insert panels is ridiculous.
It's like some Alan Moore shit.
Well, I mean, not quite Alan Moore, but extremely detailed in what Zach wanted on this page. So I highly recommend that you read that script page. And then, I mean, you'll see what the page looks like immediately after. It's the second page, second and third page, I think it is. But yeah, really, really good, really good. All right, let's rate this one up. I'll go first, and I'll give it a 4 out of 5 because it's the bomb. It just hits on all the themes and genres that I really love. So I love this stuff.
Yeah, dude, I love the art. You know, I think it's very intriguing. And you know, it's good hard sci-fi. So, I'm going to go 5 out of 5. Fight Donaldson's Planet Tamos.
Nice. Dig it. All right. Next week, we have two books. We've got Lost City Explorers #2. Of course, we all really dug the first one. And we've got Clan Killers #1 coming out next week. And I know there was a preview for Clan Killers on both books this week. I wish Ronnie could have made it because he had some stuff to say about it. But I guess we'll find out next week when the book comes out.
Yeah, better to base it on a full issue rather than a couple pages.
Yes. Well, and I will say what I told Ronnie is I rather enjoy the little preview pages. Ronnie, maybe not so much.
Yeah, I'm intrigued. I will admit that it definitely, you know, seems a bit challenging, but that's not a bad thing.
No, not at all.
All right. And I'm just so stoked whenever a new Aftershock title comes out, you know, like that's just always so exciting. So, new Aftershock book, good news to me.
Hell yeah. All right, you can find us all on Twitter. Ronnie's at Rumbar316. Tell him how much you missed him. Travis is at The Great Williams. I'm at Geekvine. The show is at Aftershock Pod. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week.